Kia ora tātou and welcome to this edition of Asia Insight, the podcast from the Asia New Zealand Foundation, Te Whitu Te Hono in Wellington. I'm Graham Acton. The China Tightrope is a new book from journalist Sam Sachdeva, currently National Affairs Editor at newsroom.co.nz in Wellington. The book's an examination of the China-New Zealand relationship, how we got to where we are today and what the future may hold. I spoke to Sam as New Zealand Prime Minister Chris Hipkins prepares for his upcoming visit to China and began by asking him how the book moved from idea to reality.
I actually got approached by the publisher Allen and Unwin towards the end of 2021, and they had, you know, seen my work in this area. You know, I'd started at Newsroom as a foreign affairs editor, branched out a little more broadly into politics, but I've always had that foreign affairs interest. And they said, look, we think there's a gap in the market for this. People are very interested in China. They need to know more about it. And I thought about it, and first of all, I thought, do I have the energy and time to do this? And I decided, yes, probably. And is there value in it? And I think there is. Whether or not this is the perfect book, I mean, that's, I don't know, clearly it's not perfect. It's for others to decide its merits. But I think this is just something we need to be talking about more openly, the relationship with China and some of the difficulties that we're encountering these days. So it's my attempt to make a modest contribution towards encouraging that debate.
So as far as that debate goes, how do you see the New Zealand media's coverage of the issues that you raise in the book?
It's reasonable, slightly hamstrung in parts, I guess, just by resourcing issues. If you talk about the fact that New Zealand has not had a foreign correspondent based in China for decades, right? We just don't have that on-the-ground reporting, and, you know, that's something that I didn't have the ability to talk to people who are in China, but to be on the ground there and do things. And part of that is the Chinese government's approach to visas and so on. But, you know, more generally, I think it is improving. Certainly when I first started reporting on foreign affairs issues in 2017, there was pretty much no competition, but that's changing now. You are getting more reporters and more media outlets who are putting focus into this, but it is relatively shallow at points and very much led by some of the high-level political debate rather than getting into the weeds and some of the detail.
I mean, one thing that comes through in the book, Sam, is that New Zealand's relationship with China is quite complicated. Why do you think it's so complicated?
Well, we've been an early adopter for so long, right? You know, you have these four or five firsts, maybe it's more than that now, but to have been out at the front of the pack on a lot of these initiatives, you know, first Western country to sign an FTA, first Western country to back them into the WTO, it's put us at the forefront of a lot of the stuff. So we're, you know, an early innovator, or if you take a more pessimistic view, as others have, we're, you know, potentially a guinea pig, or Dr. Anne-Marie Brady has used the phrase canary in the coal mine. Mm. So I think it's an adjustment from that, where we've had a very clear leading approach to China, and now it's just getting more complicated and trying to recalibrate from that. Whereas I think other countries who have maybe had a more reserved approach, as China's changed its tack and become more assertive, it's been easier for them to moderate their approach, whereas we're kind of feeling our way through it, I think, and going away from our willingness to be the first to sign anything when it comes to China.
We continue. I suppose the criticism is, or maybe not the criticism, but the analysis is that we are putting the risks to trade ahead of our principles as a nation, and we haven't always done that. If you think about South Africa or the nuclear testing or whatever else, you know, in the past we have been able to put the principles in front of the trade, in front of the transactions. Is that your perspective on what we're doing, and how do we move forward under that?
I mean, I think there is morality there. There's probably a slight disconnect between government and business, where I think the government's messaging has been, again, they tread very carefully when it comes to talking about human rights in relation to China, given that effect on trade, but they are a little bit more outspoken, whereas, you know, I think the business sector say, this is a crucial market for us, you encouraged us to get into this market, we've invested a lot of time and money, we're making great profits, why are you trying to sort of force us to look elsewhere? So it is complicated, and I understand it. I don't think any government should recklessly jeopardise our economic well-being, but we have these principles and we do need to stand up to them, for them. So it's complex, and I think we need to be a little bit better in this space and just confident in ourselves, I guess, and say that, look, we have to articulate our values and interests. If we do that in a country agnostic manner, where what we say to China should, when we have concerns, should be the same as what we'll say to the United States or Australia, as we've talked about their, you know, approach to deportees, then we should be on solid ground. The problem is that we've seen instances with other countries, and Australia is a very recent example, where China has politically has used tariff measures and trade measures as a political tool when they've had political disagreements. So there's a very obvious case study of the risks to New Zealand.
I suppose Australia is a very good example of a country that decides, well, did it put its principles in front of its trade? I'm not sure if it sort of maybe was just a little bit too belligerent for Beijing in a way.
I take that view. And I think you've seen a recalibration under the new government in Canberra, the Albanese Labor government, where they are still outspoken on issues related to the South China Sea, treatment of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang, but without an unnecessary chest thumping, or, you know, what was the term that Tony Abbott used in relation to Russia? I think was shirt fronting. And that's, we've seen some of that with China. And that can be, there is sometimes a place for that, but also I think it needs to be kept in moderation. And I think they did overreach, and probably, you know, Damien O'Connor got a lot of criticism for this when he said that they needed to take a more respectful approach. And it's one of those things you don't say out loud and you don't say to the media, but maybe it's right. I'd argue if you look at Australia now, they're coming back slightly more closely to the New Zealand approach of dealing with China, albeit still probably a little bit more forceful and with a different view given their relationships with the US.
So what's the best way for New Zealand to communicate its concerns to Beijing, do you think?
I think we raise them publicly and specifically. We don't need to be entirely veiled. You know, I think we hear sometimes politicians, and this has been across governments, talking about, you know, we urge all countries in the South China Sea to respect the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. It's like, well, we're talking about one country really, aren't we, in terms of the militarization of the area. But I think we just need to frame it in a positive sense, not a negative sense, not a, you know, China is doing these bad things and it's wrong and immoral, even if some of that might be true. We say this is what New Zealand stands for. We believe in freedom of expression, freedom of beliefs, the rules-based order, and so on. And that becomes a bit of a cliche in the New Zealand context that's used to death. But I think it is important you say this is what we believe in, and if any country falls foul of that in their actions, then we will speak out, and we'll do it across the board.
One of the interesting chapters in the book was regarding the PRC's soft power in New Zealand and the way that China has in the past attempted to put its story forward more forcefully in New Zealand in the Chinese language media, in university funding, political party funding, etc. How much of an issue do you think that is in New Zealand in 2023?
I think it's a real issue. I think there is greater awareness now and greater activity or education on the behalf of government agencies. If you look at our intelligence services, and I think I mentioned this in the book, they've put out publicly guidelines in relation to foreign interference for academics, for local politicians, and for national politicians. So saying, well, and it's not talking about China, because the risks do apply across the board, but saying, here's what you need to look out for. Here's why when someone approaches the NRC to do something, it may not be entirely benign, and here's the process. So it is a concern. And people I talk to, even those who think the concerns about China are overblown across the board, they do raise the Chinese language media landscape as a particular concern, because I don't think there's a lot of visibility, and regulation is sort of there's a bit of a gap there. I've talked to the Media Council chairman about this before, and he said, you know, this is not something that we can look at, whether or not the Chinese state has any sort of role in what this outlet is reporting on, or whether it's following censorship rules that are required for it to work on WeChat. It's outside of our purview. So there's sort of a gap there that needs to be addressed.
As far as China's soft power in New Zealand, is political party funding the key weakness, do you think?
I think it's a critical one, and it was raised by a lot of people I spoke to for the book. You know, that we had this announcement in 2019, I think, that we've banned overseas donations, and there was a big to-do made about it. But in fact, we haven't, because, yes, overseas individuals can't donate, but if you are a entirely overseas owned but New Zealand domiciled company, you can give as much money as you want. And there was some controversy around this in relation to the Inner Mongolia Horse Rider Company, which gave $150,000 to National and is owned by a Chinese billionaire with an interest in horse racing. So there was no suggestion that there was anything illegal there, but that was raised as a concern that does this fit within the spirit of the law and do we want to allow that? So no, nothing's happened in that space yet. We've had the Independent Electoral Review come back and actually suggest that only people who are registered to vote in New Zealand should be able to give money. And that would fix a lot of these issues, not necessarily all of them. But whether or not that becomes gets adopted by the government after the election, which is when they'll get the final report, who knows?
Just talking about the Inner Mongolia Horse Rider Industry Limited as a company in New Zealand, do you know what, are they involved in any activity at all in New Zealand?
Not that I'm aware of. I think, I haven't looked at this in detail, I'll confess, but I think that they were looking perhaps at exporting some horses to China or doing some breeding work, but I don't know where that's got to. I think they actually may have run into financial difficulties during the COVID-19 pandemic from memory. I think the New Zealand Herald had a story, but I'm not quite sure on that.
How difficult was it to get people to talk to you about this and other issues? I note that Jacinda Ardern and Christopher Luxon, neither of those spoke to you.
Yeah, look, it was difficult, and not just with politicians. You know, I think some in the business sector I approached and initially expressed an interest in talking, and then said, oh, no, look, I've thought about it, and I think there's too many risks in terms of saying something wrong. Certainly members of the Chinese community, I spoke to a number anonymously who are quoted in there, and there's a more sort of visceral and personal risk there. But there is certainly political sensitivity. I mean, I think Simon O'Connor is quoted as a sitting MP, but most of the other politicians I spoke to are former ministers, former MPs, who are a little bit freed from the restraints of, you know, following the MFAT line or the government line on China. So it's a tricky one, and I can understand why they shy away from it. But actually, we need to talk about this more. It's so crucial.
Yes, you think that Christopher Luxon would take the opportunity to?
Yeah, I will say I'm just trying to remember. I don't know that I approached him. I think I had prioritised other interviews, so it may be that I didn't proactively ask him. But I will say I have had a standing request in with his office for several months now to have a broader talk to him about foreign policy, and there was nothing has been forthcoming in that space. So I think there might be a view that there's more downsides than upsides in talking about things like China and Taiwan and the South China Sea.
I saw also that one of New Zealand's key China scholars, Anne-Marie Brady, also chose not to speak to you. Why was that?
Yeah, so she had initially expressed a enthusiasm to talk and a willingness to do what she could to help, but I think she went away and thought about it. And, you know, I quote her on this in the book. She formed the view that I lack the necessary expertise on the CCP's internal workings and Chinese language skills to add anything to the, you know, the public discussion about this. And she said, you know, look, I've laid out all my views and my work and you're welcome to look at that. And I respect that. Obviously, it's her decision and it's up to her to decide whether or not it's worth her time to talk to me. I guess my view is that, you know, yes, I'm not a CCP expert. Yes, I'm not fluent or don't speak any Chinese languages, but that's why I've spoken to people who are experts in those areas. So I think, you know, she has had a tough time in terms of being in the media spotlight in New Zealand. The controversy around her magic weapons paper and then the break-ins at her house, and has probably become much more of a public figure than anyone would want. So I can understand a reticence to perhaps get into it in any more detail.
Just more broadly, how do you think the topic of China writ large may impact the upcoming election in New Zealand?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, foreign policy doesn't tend to really come to the fore in elections, and maybe we're the poorer for it. But we've seen a divergence of opinions in relation to AUKUS, which is tangentially rather than directly related to China, but it does come into play if you look at, you know, why that security pact has been formed. So I think you've got an interesting sort of grouping of interests there. You know, the sort of traditional left who are, you know, somewhat anti-American and concerned about American overreach. You've got advocates of the Pacific and people who are concerned about maintaining our nuclear-free policy. So that seems to me like it might be the one issue that could actually break through and lead to the parties sort of staking out their positions. Labour has been non-committal. National has been also non-committal, but perhaps a little bit more willing to criticise it in some respects. Jerry Brownlee, who's their foreign affairs spokesman, doesn't seem to be a huge fan, but it's kind of cutting through in a way that foreign policy issues generally don't in New Zealand.
What do you think the advantage to New Zealand of joining AUKUS would be?
I think the advantage that has been laid out by some academics and by others with an interest in this is that we want to be in the room when these standards are set, and we have no interest in the nuclear pillar, Pillar One. That's not something New Zealand would ever do, and I think that there is no party that would advocate a different approach to that. But if you look at the work in relation to artificial intelligence, quantum technologies, hypersonic technologies, we may not be able to pay for all of that ourselves, and we may not want to take all of it up, but we will have a stake in sort of how the standards are set for that and what approach is taken. So if we're not in the room for that, there is a risk that maybe we get shut out in terms of framing some of that discussion. So that's probably the strongest argument in favour of having a role.
Just going back to the Pacific for a minute, I'm interested in your views on China in the Pacific, the idea especially that you mentioned in the book about a regional body of some kind being constructed similar to ASEAN.
Mm.
And how would that work, and how do you think New Zealand could contribute to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and it was raised by Anna Poles and Joanne Wallace recently, that you could have a sort of a security body that's similar to ASEAN. So, I mean, I think you would look to use the Pacific Islands Forum. It exists. It seems to have recovered a little bit after the instability in recent years when, you had Kiribati looking at leaving, or in fact did leave and then came back. I think New Zealand would be best placed to offer, some funding potentially and the expertise of our officials, but I don't think we could be too prescriptive or demanding in terms of inserting ourselves into that, because there is a risk of being too paternalistic, and that's been the whole point of the Pacific Reset and now the Pacific Resilience approach that this government has taken, to say that we can't really dictate terms to the Pacific. We want to partner with them and enable them to make these decisions themselves.
Just on Chris Hipkins' upcoming visit to China, what do you think, or what do you hope to see from that, and what do you expect he may come back with?
Well, it's interesting. There seems to be little in the way of obvious wins for him to take away, at least tangible wins. So we've had the FTA upgrade, which came into effect. I think that might have been last year at some point. I can't recall when it was officially signed. So I don't know that there's much headway to make in that space. It's probably the messaging and symbolism as much as anything, saying that, New Zealand is back. We want to be involved in China. We've got all these great sectors and businesses that are of interest. So I think that'll be the main message. It's very trade focused. The challenges for him will be, how does he handle this issue of human rights and articulating New Zealand's values, and what pressure does he come under from, if he meets Xi Jinping, and that hasn't been confirmed yet, or and if he does interviews with Chinese media, again, not confirmed, but it wouldn't shock me. How does he navigate those issues of speaking positively about the relationship while still asserting or talking about the areas where New Zealand does have concern?
Well, Sam, just to remind people about the book, it's Allen and Unwin Publishers, and it's called The China Tightrope, Navigating New Zealand's Relationship with the World Superpower, and it's out in New Zealand bookstores right now. The question that comes out of it for me is really, is New Zealand's political morality too limited by its trade pragmatism and too easily fudged as independent foreign policy?
I think the short answer is yes. The long answer is yes, but there are things we can do to address that. So, I think it's something we're really going to have to grapple with. And there are some maybe slightly positive signs recently that US-China tensions may improve. And, there's been some meetings, and I think, and some talk. But realistically, I think, at least for the medium term, these issues are not going to go away. So we're going to have to, give ourselves a greater education, or take greater account of the changing face of China, externally and internally, and figure out, how do we advocate for our interests more strongly without going into a full trade war or risking consequences for New Zealand businesses.
Thanks for your time today, Sam.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Asia Insight. Mihi koe, moto whakarongo mai. Thanks for listening. Ka kite anō.